It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're talking about the cultural shift underway about the nature of sexual assault as Harvey Weinstein was convicted this week. So outside of Hollywood and the cameras trained on that Manhattan courtroom during the six-week trial, what will be the next chapter of the Me Too movement? How will your workplace change? Have you changed since allegations against Weinstein really ignited Me Too back in 2017? Your thoughts are welcome here at 800-642-1234. Shireen Alamzada is an attorney and the co-founder of Healing to Action. That nonprofit works to end gender violence. She is a legal expert on workplace sexual violence, and she's litigated sexual harassment, sexual assault, and civil rights cases. Shireen, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with that verdict. A jury found Harvey Weinstein guilty of two felony sex crimes, criminal sexual assault in the first degree and rape in the third degree. How is this verdict significant?
Well, it's there's a lot of, so just to break down the verdict a little bit more, these were cases of different two different victims, Jessica Mann and Maryam Halei, and they were cases that were brought along with a third victim testifying that some of this conduct had happened to her in the past. And all three cases had some elements to them that typically, I think, prior to the Weinstein case and the Me Too movement, would have been difficult for prosecutors to bring. And so I think there's a couple of pieces of significance here. The first is that there was accountability for Harvey Weinstein, whose case was highly publicized, who became one of the sort of most prominent foils in the Me Too movement. And then I think the other one is that it was an example of how the criminal justice system is starting to look a little bit differently at cases like this, given perhaps that the cultural conversation is shifting to help to explain the public's understanding of, to clarify the public's understanding of sexual assault a little bit more.
What have you seen in the evolution of how we view sexual assault since Me Too started?
So I think that it's become, there have just been so many more stories that have come out that really give a shape and a face and really just a lot more detail to what these situations look like. I think what has become clear, one thing that's become clear is how prevalent this problem is, that it's happening to people across different industries, that it's happening to people from different walks of life all over the world. And so that's just helped to provide, I think, a little bit of cover for people to come forward without shame and really share the stories of what they actually went through. I think another piece of what's changed is that, you know, you have people really understanding in a lot more, with a lot more clarity, the choices that people are, that survivors are forced to make, that sexual assault is not always so black and white, that common understandings of how it happens are not necessarily the way that it normally does happen. And so you just have a better sense now of the fact that survivors often know the people that harm them, that they often have very complicated feelings about what's happened to them, and the level of shame and stigma that's attached to this that has stopped people for such a long time from coming forward is finally starting to lift. But now people start to understand why that shame and stigma was there for so long.
We're talking with Shireen Alamzada. She's a legal expert on workplace sexual violence. And we're looking at the guilty verdict this week of movie producer Harvey Weinstein. Have you been following the Weinstein trial? What do you make of the guilty verdict? Has the Me Too movement made you think differently about sexual assault survivor experiences? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Shireen, Weinstein was also acquitted on several charges, one being predatory sexual assault. Why was it difficult for the prosecution to prove predatory sexual assault?
So under New York penal law, in order to prove predatory sexual assault, you have to show that the defendant engaged in a pattern of first-degree rape or first-degree criminal sexual acts against more than one victim. And the verdict here, the jury found that he was guilty of third-degree rape against Jessica Mann, and then first-degree criminal sexual act against Miriam Halei. So there was only one conviction in the first degree. Now, if the jury had found that he had also engaged in first-degree criminal sexual act or first-degree rape against a third victim who testified, whose claim fell outside of the statute of limitations, then that could have elevated the conviction against the two other victims to predatory sexual assault, which can carry a lifetime prison sentence. Ultimately, though, it seems like what happened was that the jury only found, based on the evidence that they heard, that he committed one first-degree offense against one person. So that's why he wasn't convicted of that greater offense of predatory sexual assault.
Weinstein's attorney has made some comments suggesting that women are partially responsible for protecting themselves from sexual assault and harassment. What is your reaction to the sentiment from Weinstein's defense?
So I think that, you know, that's an easy sort of, I think that's an effective way to try to defend your client, to make these kinds of comments. I think it does certainly gloss very much over the power dynamics between Weinstein and the women who testified in this case. He was, you know, and I think that that's just one reflection or one example of how the choices that we talk about women or anybody who's experiencing sexual violence making are really false choices. Thinking about, you know, the question in this particular case, why did you go back? Conveniently ignoring the fact that he is one of the most powerful people in the industry who had, during some of the crimes that he committed, some extremely powerful political connections across the country. And really glossing over the real decision they were faced with. It wasn't about, you know, what the attorney talked about was, you know, why did you decide to go up to the hotel room, or why did you decide to contact him afterwards? The real decision point for these particular survivors was, do I want my career destroyed? Do I want to be the subject of vindictive retaliation? Or do I want to keep this extremely powerful person who has the ability to destroy my life happy? And that's really the decision that we need to be looking at, rather than talking about the responsibility that survivors play, is understanding and exploring with some moral clarity the choices that we're asking people to make, to throw away their livelihoods, to throw away their professional identity, in some cases to compromise their economic survival, simply because someone else has decided that they're entitled to their body. So I would really encourage people to refocus their attention on what really needs to be under the microscope, which is the brutality of that choice that we're telling people they have to make, as though they really have some autonomy or some agency in that decision.
You've been thinking about this notion of the perfect victim. Is there a quote unquote perfect victim out there?
I definitely don't think there is. And I think that, you know, there is always a way to normalize harm that happens to people and to blame survivors for what's happened to them. I mean, this goes to, you know, every example you can think of. I mean, there's stories of, I've heard stories of children being blamed for experiencing sexual abuse from a trusted adult. You hear stories all the time of survivors of intimate partner violence being blamed for picking the wrong person, you know, extremely vulnerable workers being blamed for staying in an abusive workplace because they need to feed their kids. There's always a way to turn scrutiny onto a person who's been harmed and say that they're not a real victim. And I think what's starting to change is that survivors, like the women in this case, are really starting to name the harm that they suffered, even though they know that not everyone is going to believe that they're a perfect victim. And I think that is extremely powerful.
Talking with attorney Shireen Alamzadeh right here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us, back in a moment. If you're just joining us, it's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Some questions here to think about. How have perceptions of what constitutes sexual harassment changed in the era of Me Too? Was this week's Harvey Weinstein conviction an indication that there is real change in how Americans perceive sexual assault? And one thing that's emerged is that sexual assault allegations can be complicated. They can be complicated by lapses in memory and the silence of victims who are in these professional or personal relationships with their assaulter. Has your workplace taken steps to change, to eliminate harassment? What works? Join in 800-642-1234. Shireen Alamzada has litigated sexual harassment, sexual assault, and civil rights cases, and she stays with us. Let's take a call now. Jesse is here from Green Bay. Hi, Jesse.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm so glad you guys are having this conversation. I definitely think it's something that we really need to be paying attention to. I just get concerned that, you know, yes, these are wins and they're momentous wins, but I don't think that we've come as far as we would like to in breaking down the victim shaming. And I think, you know, far too often we hear, you know, well, this is how to avoid it. And your guest kind of mentioned this before the break. You know, this is how to protect yourself. And I feel like we just need to really drive home that fact that if they didn't say yes, then the answer was no and nothing should have occurred. So it doesn't matter if they went back knowing this. You know, it doesn't matter if they went to a closed door. You know, none of that matters. The truth is there was no consent given and therefore their rights were violated. And I don't know where in time we strayed from that, you know, from an adamant and enthusiastic yes is the only way you proceed. But I really hope we move back to that at some point in time.
Jesse, thank you for the comments, the call. Shireen, you know, have we ventured too far from no means no? And is this a watershed moment or should we be very concerned about victim shaming?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's hard to attribute the direction of an entire, you know, cultural conversation to the outcome of a single case. But I think that certainly the case was a watershed in that it was bringing forward claims that a lot of people wouldn't have understood previously as sexual assault, not necessarily all people, but a lot of people in the culture that maybe didn't understand these issues very well and really brought them to the forefront. But at the same time, I agree very much with the caller because I think it's important to remember that the particular witnesses in this case that testified to their experiences did experience an enormous amount of shaming, minimization of what happened to them, blame through the legal process. And yeah, I think it's possible that more cases will be brought like this, but it didn't. This case in this moment doesn't necessarily signal that survivors will be treated with more dignity in the legal system. And I think what the caller is speaking to is that we do need to change the stereotypes and the misunderstandings in our culture that make humiliating survivors a winning strategy for defense teams, because ultimately our legal system is really a reflection of our culture. It's not a separate thing. So if we can't change those deeper cultural attitudes, we're going to keep sending survivors into these situations in courtrooms, depositions, in society at large. And we need to create the conditions where people aren't rationally terrified to come forward because of how they're going to be treated.
We're talking with Shireen Alamzada, an attorney, co-founder of Healing to Action. That's a nonprofit organization that works to end gender violence. Let's take another call now. Lisa is with us from Janesville this morning. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, I'm calling, and this touches on the culture issue. Recently at UW-Eau Claire, Chancellor Schmidt made a comment regarding, I believe it was the assistant chancellor, that other women had come forward who said they did not feel harassed by him. And I think that's the culture of, well, if somebody thinks he's a really nice guy, maybe that's not true. And as a sexual assault survivor, I can, you know, attest to the fact that when I came forward, I was not believed because there were a lot of people who thought that my assailant was a really great guy. And it's this cultural issue of everybody has to experience it or nobody experienced it.
Lisa, thank you so much for calling. Shireen, everyone has to experience it, otherwise no one experiences. Can you be the lone voice?
Well, I think, you know, it's incredibly powerful when people do come forward in those situations, and extremely difficult. And I think that a lot of times, you know, again, there's this, I totally agree with the caller that there's this understanding that there, you know, that there is just one way that sexual harm happens. And if it happens to just one person from one harm doer, that person might be mistaken or confused or telling a lie. But when you look at the Me Too movement, you see that there's millions of people that have experienced this, which means that we have to accept that some of the people that commit these acts of harm are people that we know, people we respect, people we admire, even people that we love. And that is, I think, one of the hardest conversations to have, is how can we create accountability for those people in our community, while at the same time not feeling like we have to discredit survivors who are telling the truth about their experiences.
You look closely at how sexual harassment and assault plays out in workplaces, and you describe the situation victims are in as an unjust economic choice. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think it's important, again, to place the Me Too movement outside of just the parameters of the Harvey Weinstein case. There's just across so many different industries, there is this choice that people have to make between their economic survival and putting up with sexual abuse or sexual harassment. And this happens in hotels, with workers, housekeepers experiencing harassment from guests, restaurants where servers are experiencing harassment from people that give them tips, factory lines where, you know, production workers are being assaulted by supervisors, retail workers being stalked by customers. It is a problem that is so pervasive, and it's really important that we understand that for most people that experience this, because the communities that are most impacted are low-income communities, communities of color, people with disabilities, you know, LGBTQ communities, that this is not merely a matter of, you know, finding another job or leaving or quitting an abusive workplace. This is a matter of, these are communities that have been historically impoverished by, due to a lot of structural inequalities. And so for them, leaving these jobs is literally sometimes losing a roof over their head, not being able to buy diapers for their child, not being able to put food on the table for their family. So there's these very real survival questions that come up for so many people when they experience sexual violence, and we need to be aware of, and we need to be talking about those kinds of decisions that we are forcing people to make when we don't address the problem of sexual violence in the workplace.
Let's really quickly take Mark in Reedsburg, who's with us. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to know specifically what he did. If I understand what I remember from past reports, he basically said, if you don't have sex with me, I'm going to hurt you in some way. I'm going to hurt your career or whatever. And under those circumstances, why would somebody not be charged with extortion? Because I think that is extortion.
Mark, thanks for the call. Shireen, can you comment on that?
That is a great question, and I can't speak to why specific charges were brought because I was not on the prosecution team. But there are, I think that the caller points to the fact that there were a lot of different legal violations that this behavior could be characterized as, and there's still actually quite a few civil cases that are pending against Weinstein, as well as some more criminal charges that are in California right now. So I think, you know, the question of how these different charges or how these different acts could be characterized legally is still playing out.
Yeah, and he'll be sentenced on these charges early next month, and his attorneys are promising an appeal. As you mentioned, there are also charges against him in Los Angeles County. What are you watching for here in this case?
I actually haven't been watching the LA case particularly closely, so I don't want to speak to it. But I think that a couple of things to just be watching for are how trial strategy or how things might be, how the lessons from the New York case might be applied to these other contexts. I think the New York case was significant in that it was an experiment in using certain theories of liability, as I mentioned before, that, and certain theories of the case that hadn't traditionally been used by prosecutors. So seeing if that pattern continues, I think will be really interesting to watch in other criminal legal systems.
Oh, seeing if there's precedent here.
Seeing if there has been, if there's strategies. So right now there's no precedent in the case because there hasn't been an appeal. There's no binding law in the case that could be applied to future, future defendants or future cases. But seeing if the case has set, an informal kind of example that prosecutors across the country might follow.
Shireen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Shireen Alamzada is an attorney in Chicago, co-founder of Healing to Action. Coming up, a Door County folk musician has a new album out. Katie Dahl joins us to share her inspirations, and we hear a bit of her music. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Stay with us. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. We have a Northwoods enthusiast singer-songwriter on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Door County's Katie Dahl describes herself as a folk musician, but her latest work, she admits, has a bit more of a rock and roll feel. We're listening to a song called The Fisherman's Daughter from her latest album called Wildwood.
I know the fisherman's story, a boat across the sea. Cut a clearing, built a cabin, planted an apple tree.
What do you want to know about being a folk musician in Wisconsin? What questions do you have about writing music? Do you live in Door County? What should folk musicians be singing about? We're at 800-642-1234. Katie Dahl tours regularly. Earlier this month, she performed for PBS Wisconsin's 30-Minute Music Hour, and she joins us from our studios in Green Bay. Katie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
So Wildwood is your fifth studio album. What do you want us to take away from your latest effort?
Well, this album is really about Door County, and it's about a strong sense of place and a history in one individual place. So I'm the sixth generation of my family living in Door County. My son is three, and he's the seventh generation. And a lot of the songs are sort of about the echoes of that history and living there now. And so I think the sense of place is, to me, the central part of the album.
After producing a few records, does it feel any easier to write about home and to record this music?
Well, I keep writing about home. Regardless of what I try to write about, I keep coming back to Door County and to sort of the places that I know. It feels to me like there are infinite depths to plumb in that respect. And so it's always interesting to me to look at different aspects of life through a narrow place-based lens. I think you can get a sort of a wide lens, a wide perspective via a small, narrow lens.
So do the ideas just come to you on the fly, like when you're living life day to day, hanging out with your three-year-old? How do you find these lyrics inside of you?
Well, ideally, they come to me on the fly. That is awesome when that happens. A lot of times I need to sit down and generate the ideas in a very undreamy way. It's not very rock and roll, but you just sit at your desk and you think, what could I write about? And then you go and get a cup of tea and procrastinate for a while until you make yourself write something. So I think writing sometimes in the easiest times it is an inspired thing, but more often for me it's a real job.
The song Wildwood Girl includes a lot of references to your life in Door County, including North Bay, Liberty Grove, and cherry trees.
You came in the season of the honeybees, heavy fruit on the cherry trees, your mother on her hands and knees on the bedroom floor, midwife running up the muddy road, all the way from Liberty Grove, same road that I drove when my boy was born.
What can you tell us about writing Wildwood Girl?
Well, my grandma, who was born in Door County in 1926, I had to change the year in the song to 1929 because it rhymed, but she was born in Door County, and she went away for the middle of her life, but she came back there, and she died there in 1997, and she, before she died, she wrote not a officially published memoir, but a memoir just that she distributed among the family. And it's a lot of stories about growing up in Door County and her childhood and what she knew of her own birth and the midwife process. And I found myself especially interested in that as I was becoming a mom and thinking about what was different or what was the same for me than it was for her or for her mom. And That's the sort of kernel of that song.
What it's like to bring the seventh generation forward.
That's right. Yep. And then to live with that generation, knowing that, thinking back to the second and third and fourth generation, sometimes we drive past where they're buried or go visit them. Or I know, this place where we're going for a chili supper is the place my grandma won a ping pong tournament in 1934 or whatever. So that sort of thing is really neat.
There's a bit of uneasiness in some of your songs. Wild Girl, you sing about blindness and broken barns and a worried mind. And then Worry, My Friend is also a bit of unease. What are you drawing on there that might bring up feelings of anxiety?
Well, I'm a worrier for sure. And I think that does run in my family, so that's part of why I was interested in exploring that on the record. But also, I think the world as a whole is worried at the moment, it feels to me. And to live in a rural place where people are on vacation and things often kind of look picture perfect is an interesting place to be, to sort of try to feel connected to the not only to the worry of the world, but to the resilience of the world, and which kind of go hand in hand to me. So I think part of my exploration of those themes had to do with soothing myself to write about how I do worry and how I would like to take my place in the world of warriors. There are many of us, and I want to sort of find kinship there.
Interesting contrast you bring up there of the tourists who come to Door County and finding lots to love and time to relax. And yet there is an undercurrent. There is life in Door County outside of tourism.
There is. I mean, and it's, you know, just as hard or beautiful as life anywhere. You know, there's a lot of hidden poverty in Door County. There's a lot of things that are hard about living in a rural place that gets pretty quiet in the wintertime. And there's a lot that is an interesting contrast to be around people who are on vacation all the time when you're working. It's an interesting place to be, and it's not a bad place to be at all. I love it so much living there, but there are challenges that are hidden.
We're talking with Door County folk musician Katie Dahl about her latest album, Wildwood, and she tours, and her next show is Saturday, by the way, at the Third Avenue Playhouse in Sturgeon Bay. Do you live in Door County or the North Woods or another part of Wisconsin? What do you think folk musicians should be singing about? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Katie, another song on the album addresses stress and loneliness, but it also provides a prescription.
A place for the tired and worn to come and rest by the water. Place for the spirit that's torn by the weariness of life. A place for the old to be reborn. To come and rest by the water.
So the song is called Breathing Room. What is it about?
Well, it's that's a song from the musical that I'm writing. It's one of two songs on the album from that musical. And the musical is about the creation of Peninsula State Park in 1908. It's really a story of two sisters' relationship, but it's set against the backdrop of this sort of eminent domain crisis that some residents of Door County found themselves in 1908. And that song is a song that a character in the play who's an agent of the Wisconsin state government and is trying to convince people to sell their land to make a state park is singing. He's touting the virtues of open space to make people feel calm and happy.
What is it like to write a musical and flex that muscle?
Very hard. it's really a whole different ball of wax than writing a song, because it's so big. It's almost like writing a novel versus writing a poem, I would imagine. And there are just feel like endless possibilities. So to me, the most challenging part of writing a musical is to invent a whole world from scratch. So the characters and their hopes and their fears and their humor, and figure out the ways in which they might interact with the world around them or each other, or and how to express all that through both words in the book of the musical and music.
Is there a stage for this musical? What's its path like here?
Well, so this show I'm working on developing with Northern Sky Theater in Door County, formerly American Folklore Theater, who I've been involved with since I was nine and first went there and totally caught the bug. And I wrote another musical, co-wrote another musical that they produced in 2012 and a couple more productions after that. And this one I'm working with them on again. So we're in the development workshop process right now.
What is it about Peninsula State Park that draws you to it, that's important to write about?
What was interesting to me that made me want to write about this was the story of one particular woman who historically in real life had to leave her house or was threatened with having to leave her house. She was a real character. Her name was Ella Wiborg, my story is not literally based on her, but it's inspired by the idea of this woman who's sort of the talk of the town for her eccentric ways. And what I was drawn to was trying to figure out what would it be like to be a woman living by yourself, 3 miles away from the middle of town in the winter time, when the roads were impassable and you didn't see anyone else and there were coyotes and bears, and what would that be like? And so it just so happened that she lived in Peninsula State Park, and there was this convenient plot twist to facilitate my exploration of that woman.
We are talking with Door County folk musician Katie Dahl, and we're going to be listening to a song here, Helen. It's from her fifth studio album called Wildwood. What draws you to folk music? What do you love about it? What kind of experiences are you seeking with the music? Be part of this conversation, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Back in a moment for more with Katie Dahl right here on the Ideas Network. We have the pleasure of a Door County folk musician here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Katie Dahl's songs, they lean on the texture of her Door County life. She's raising a family in the place where she has 6 generations of history. We have lyrics like Growing Up in the Shadow of Death's Door, Heavy Fruit on the Cherry Trees. We're listening to the song Worry My Friend off her latest album, Wildwood. Let's hear a bit of the chorus.
I've brought more trouble than I'll ever repay. Frost and snow.
Have you heard Kitty Doll perform? What are some of your favorite songs? What kinds of stories do you enjoy hearing from folk musicians? We're at 800-642-1234, and Kitty Doll stays with us. So your album Wildwood, it has a lot of wintry references. One of my favorite is a whiteout snow, my love stacking wood, mercury dropping down, long johns, darkest days. What attracts you to those wintry type references?
Well, it's too busy in the summer. There's no time to write songs. Only time to write songs in the winter. So I end up writing a lot of winter songs.
Oh, but you also make reference to a lot of summer and fall things. What do you bring up? What about the passing of the seasons and how you interplay it in music? What do you see there?
Well, I think I've always thought that changing seasons or changing locations is really informative about whatever mental ruts I've gotten into. When I change places or when the seasons change, I sort of notice, oh, I'm feeling different than I used to feel, and I didn't even realize I was feeling that way in the first place. And one nice thing about Door County is that it is so different from season to season. Weather ways, it is really different. But in terms of the people who are around and the businesses that are open, it's vastly different. And the first time I ever spent a winter in Door County, I remember the first week of November driving around and feeling like I was on a study abroad trip. Like, oh my goodness, what is this new and fantastical place I have arrived in? And I do love that. I think it really is informative, and it's helpful to have the sort of adrenaline and busyness of summer and then to have the hibernation and real quiet of the winter.
We see Door County being very supportive of the arts. Can it be hard, though, as the tourism season slows down, being a year-round resident? What is it like being a folk musician based in Door County?
Well, the pluses to me greatly outweigh the minuses. So there are constantly people visiting whose main goal is to entertain themselves, right? So they want to come out to music. Businesses are really supportive of the local music community because they need to attract patrons, and because they are just supportive and great. But I think there are a lot of places for me to play in the summer and fall without ever leaving my home, which as a parent of a young kid is such a gift. And what I do is I more and more tour in the winter. So I'm playing about 100 to 125 shows a year total. And I would say maybe 50 of those are on the road. So next month I go to Europe, 2 months I go to the East Coast. And I'm just more and more thinking of Door County as my home base and my real supportive community, and then the world as, my oyster that I'm seeking to look at even more.
What are your audiences like abroad? Have you toured abroad?
I haven't toured abroad for a long time. I had a few shows maybe 10 years ago abroad. So I don't know. I'm looking forward to finding that out. I don't speak any German or Dutch, and I'm going to Germany and the Netherlands. So I hope that they're forgiving.
Let's take a call now. Dwayne in Weston. Hi, Dwayne.
Hi. I want to look up some of her music. When you said her name, I just caught the tail end of the show. But when she started talking about like songs about chopping wood in the winter, and I still have Kate Wolf's first album from back in the day. And with her name being Kate, it's ironic because a lot of her songs were in that same path, and I can't wait to look up some of her music. And
Dwayne,
give me a name of.
Yeah. Dwayne, thank you for the call. Kitty Doll, who are your influences in music?
Well, I love Kate Wolf. I really do. And that's an honor to be to have anything about me remind anyone of her. I think she's a great giant of the folk songwriting scene. Dar Williams is a big influence for me. She's a great songwriter. Fred Alley, he was a Door County songwriter who died in 2001. I think he was pretty influential to the way I write. People like Eliza Gilkison, Lucy Kaplansky. There's a lot of wonderful folk songwriters. And actually, J.T. Nero from the band Birds of Chicago produced my album. They play a lot in Wisconsin, but they live in Nashville, and he's one of my favorite songwriters.
You, in your music, have talked about growing up in Minnesota with more funding for the arts, by the way. How? Let's listen to this upbeat ode to Minnesota here a little bit, and then we'll talk more about it.
Oh, Minnesota, I was born on your highways. I've crossed through your skyways, watched the Mississippi roll. I am your prodigal daughter, swam your 10,000 waters, spent all your shiny quarters at a bar in Sevastopol.
I can identify, Katie. I was born in Minnesota as well. Huh. What inspired this song?
Well, you know, Minnesota, I love living in Door County, and it does feel like home in some way, but I always feel like Minnesota and Wisconsin are so different, and it's not just the arts funding and the football, which are vastly of different qualities in the two states, inversely, but it's also about just the feeling of the states. And when I go across the river into Minnesota, I just feel I feel a sense of like security, like a little security blanket that I think just really you can't get any other way than growing up in a place. So that song was about exploring my roots of where I was born or where I grew up rather than where I live now, both of which feel like home.
The song Braver Than Me sounds really deeply personal, and you sing about a person being kinder and braver and skinnier. Let's take a listen.
And you were always braver than me. Better at walking through the woods in the dark. Through all those tripping trees, you held my hand. Till we fell into the full moon field with a thump in our hearts.
What should we hear in the song?
Well, I wrote this song for a friend who's having a hard time, and I think that it is – I have a lot of memories of my early 20s in Door County and the friendships that I made there. And I think it – for a long time it felt to me like Door County was a simpler place that I could go, but I think what it really was is – I was young and things weren't as complicated. And so now that I live in Door County all the time, I realize, there was a time that my friendships, I was really able to be so invested in my friendships because I didn't have a husband, I didn't have a kid, I didn't have as intense a job. And it's important to me to sort of reach out to my friends, especially this particular friend who was having a rough time, and make sure that we keep those connections alive now that we really need them.
You've been performing music for the album for a while. I'm wondering, what are some of the crowd favorites? How do the crowds receive what you're giving them?
That's a great question. The song that has done the best on folk radio is Worry My Friend.
There are other worriers out there, Katie.
There sure are. I was worried there weren't any, but there were. I think that song does seem to sort of hit home with a lot of people, Worry My Friend. I think In the Dark, which is a song I wrote about my son, that seems to really go over well. And also The Fisherman's Daughter, which is the song we opened this whole segment with. And that one, you know, is about from my musical. And that has sort of like a upbeat Irish vibe. So,
Katie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Katie Dahl is a folk musician in Door County. Her latest album is called Wildwood. As she said, she's working on a musical about the creation of Peninsula State Park, and she joined us from our studios in Green Bay. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to Katie Dahl covering Pat McDonald's Valmy right here on the Ideas Network.